Hey everyone, welcome to my latest and greatest Ag Uncensored podcast. And without getting too heavy into anything else, I have with me an old colleague of mine. I won't call you old directly, but just we've known each other for a while, and Steve Rayo. And I'm trying to think how far back it was. I want to say 08, 09, somewhere around there, when you kind of took over the helm or were part of it on the farm market at Eastside, and that's kind of where it started. But I won't tell that story, I guess. Steve, why don't tell us a little bit about yourself and what you've done and kind of what you do now, what you know, all that fun stuff. And also, thanks for being here.
Glad to join and catch up. It's been too long, and of course, we have known each other a long time, and I won't bore everyone with my full background, but probably focus more on the most recent background. But my background is kind of finance, business strategy, and I came into the ag industry by way of we acquired a couple companies that were owned by a holding company. One was Farm Market ID. Be quite honest, when we bought it, my background functionally is in data and analytics, and I'd been running a data and analytics company for a while. And we bought this company. I'd like to say that we really understood what we bought and or had any idea about the ag industry or what the ag industry needs, but we were pretty naive, to be honest, and didn't really know. The positive side is after learning what we bought or really trying to understand it, realized we had something really, really cool and special. At the time, again, this is 2009, I think is when we bought it. And I probably got to know you shortly thereafter. Farm Market ID was a company that compiled data largely from the U.S. government under Freedom of Information Act. And they had gotten access via long drawn out lawsuit and appeal to the farm field boundaries, what are known as the common land unit data, linking nearly every acre, at least that had ever been under a farm program, and connecting it to the people who own and operate it. So we had all the farm field boundaries covering 900 million acres with who owns it, who operates it. And after really understanding, again, we didn't really understand it at first.
It's a lot of data. We were working together, I mean, it's what, 35 million polygons or something like that?
Yeah. That's about right. Well, it grew exponentially because when you take those polygons and owners and operators, which change from year to year, mm-hmm. and then you layer on top of that different, because we worked with you guys on the remote sensing, and crop classification stuff. Now you're putting crops in the field. Then you go to the next step. Okay, what else can we deduce from satellite imagery? And for me, the way I understood it is, well, fields don't make decisions. Farmers make decisions, but farmers only make decisions based on the fields. So if you're trying to understand the farmer, you have to understand their fields. If you want to understand what they may want, what they may need, or how they're thinking about farming, which everybody in agribusiness does, you need to understand the fields. So mm-hmm. we really approach from two sides. We delve deeper to understanding the farmers and bringing in consumer demographics, age, education level. We added machine learning, which is now more thought of as AI, to understand farmer personas. Are you someone who likes to use technology in farm? Are you a brand loyalist? Things like that. But with the fields, we kept adding data, including towards the end of my reign, prior to us selling to DTN, we started bringing in some sustainability data, mm-hmm. tillage practices, use of cover crop and some other things. Now you can start to understand kind of their carbon footprint. I think, and then, you know, when you keep adding those against 35 million field boundaries, against 900 million acres year to year, it grew exponentially. And I had always had a mandate that we never lose granularity. Mm-hmm. Always kept it as granular as we possibly could, because you could always roll it up.
Yes,
but it became a beast. But it was a lot of fun. And then obviously we sold to D10, and with D10 I really focused on innovation and sustainability.
Well, yeah, and just, you know, speaking from the farm market ID side, like, that data was always, it was so interesting to look at it and play with it, because you could see so many things. But one, I know, at least when we were trying to work on some stuff together with it and do some large partnerships with some large corporate entities, the one thing that was always, it was always kind of weird, because, you know, large ag corporate groups, you know, they love data. The more data for marketing purposes and everything, the better to understand their clients. I mean, that's like their whole thing. And it's even more so now than it was then. But, you know, because the ownership data is there, but the operator side was always kind of, it's like that, kind of the golden goose of data in a sense, even though a lot of local, you know, groups kind of know that already in their own local niche areas, but on a broad national scale, that's when it really gets complicated. And it was always surprising that some of the groups, at least early on, were kind of scared of that data, because there was this kind of adage that, oh, it's secret on who farms it. I'm like, what's secret about it? I can go drive out in the country and I know exactly what fields my neighbors farm. There's nothing secret about it. Yeah. And it was just always a kind of a weird thing. Like, you know, so just talking about that quick, did that wane? Did that kind of thought wane?
I don't think it was ever. Well, first of all, there was fear of, oh, what if our farmer customers know we have this data?
Yeah.
And that was more perceived than real. In the whole time, you know, since we owned Farmark ID, I guess from 2009 until we sold it in 2021, on one hand, and not even probably like a Simpson's hand with three or four fingers, I could count the number of times, we weren't working directly with farmers, but any time that it bubbled up to us, which is, how did you get my information?
Mm-hmm.
You know, how dare you? I could put it on a hand. Now, I'm sure it happened more than we knew about it, and they would talk to their retails. Sure. But yeah, I mean, farmers generally understood and knew that they were participating in these farm programs, and some data was available. And let's also not be naive, particularly even though 2009 is a long time ago, we're all online, and we all know that data is being captured and used. So. And I think that myth still exists today. I hear it over and over again. People are like, farmer data. Farmers are really paranoid. They won't do this or that because they don't want to release their data. They don't want to give their data willy-nilly, not knowing where it goes and not being compensated for it. Yeah, I agree with that. But if they were so paranoid about their data, I mean, look at like a system like FieldView. It's got a tremendous amount of information and data in there.
Mm-hmm.
But they use it. Why do they use it? Because they're getting value out of it. It benefits them. So yeah, if you ask farmers to give you a data and you don't give them a benefit, and it's not clear how you're going to use the data, they do have reservations. But this idea that they somehow don't want anyone else to see their data is nonsense.
Well,
there are some, but
I think it might have just been the sign of the time, because it was early on, and you know, social media and data mining stuff was still relatively unknown, and even other software. So I think it was just the moment in time that seemed to be kind of a fear, even though, like, I mean, especially the groups that have, you know, GMOs, like, you'd have to sign a piece of paper saying, this is exactly where I'm putting my soybeans. I'm like, yeah, that's the same data. Why are you scared of it? Like, yeah, I remember having that argument with one of the groups, but
it's just a question of transparency.
Yeah. Yeah.
And what are you giving me? And what are you doing? You know, so the transparency, who's going to get it? What are you going to do with it? And what do I get in return? If you can answer those three questions satisfactorily, and it's proven over and over again, farmers will do it. But if you can't tell them, and I won't cite some of the examples, but there were some public examples, you know, was it about 4 or 5 years ago, a really bad handling.
Was it the one that made?
I'm not gonna say, but it was one that very quickly became public and very quickly was shut down. So I think you know what I'm talking about. And you know,
to all those out there, I'll say it. It's tillable.
I'm not commenting.
Hey, this is called Ag Uncensored.
Uncensored,
right? Yeah, this is called Ag Uncensored, not Ag pulled out everything. I know what you're saying though, and honestly, like just from that though, it brings up a good point because, like, I was actually, talking with them at the time. I was at Ag Integrated, and we were going to try to, you know, this whole fear of like, oh, they're connected to climate, they know all our data, and it's like. They didn't even have the API connection done. It wasn't even developed. So yeah. The whole thing was just this kind of fear rumor thing. And it got going on Ag Talk, which is a popular blog. Yeah. And I remember seeing it and I was like, I think I even emailed the Tillable guys and I was like, it's like, I feel really bad for you guys. Yeah. You could have marketed it a little differently. And that was the problem. They basically had let's market this value prop to landowners and let's market this value prop to operators, to farmers and see where they merge. Well, a lot of those people are the same people and they didn't splice out who they were sending the same letter to more or less. And that was a mistake. I know they admitted to that. They're like, yeah, we didn't have the connection done at all. We were just saying we were going to do it. And, it didn't help that the founder, he used to be at Climate and all that. And I'll have to get him on here and he can tell the whole story because, you know, why not at this point?
I mean, that's one of those examples where it only takes the exception becomes the rule, the perception becomes the reality. And as a whole, I mean, I've worked in the data industry now for 15, 16 years outside of ag before that. And, you know, these things happen, and it is a pervasive problem where the exception becomes the rule in the public's view. And then the problem is then everyone closes down closes the gates. And but you really need that data collaboration amongst companies and farmers to agribusiness for farmers to be able to make better decisions, more profitable decisions. And the businesses to do the same. So there's value in doing it and being open about data. But when you have, not saying it was a bad actor, but you have something that happens that puts this fear out there, and then no one wants to make it seem like they aren't protecting the data or aren't doing anything responsible with it. But again, just in my experience, if you're transparent, it's clear who's getting it and what they're doing with it. And it's legal and all that. We never had a problem in our whole time at Farmark ID, not to say we somehow did things better, but you know, we were always very, very transparent, around where the data came from and any data from our clients, not one single piece of that was used. So, because our clients would have that. Because if we send you our file, I said it would actually be harder for us to use that because we don't know if your data is right.
Well, that's a good point because that is one thing I've always argued against groups that have said, they got ours and they can do all this stuff with it. I'm like, do you know your data is probably crap and you don't even know it? You just in your head. Like a great example, when I would help, I'd help a local farmer do some custom combining where I used to live. Just why not? It's if you haven't driven a combine, it's one of the funnest things ever. But I was, I was looking at, and it had a integrated yield monitor. It wasn't a separate one, but even the integrated ones aren't great because half the time they're not calibrated. And we were going up and down the field and it's like, oh, I'm getting 120 bushels an acre here for wheat. I'm like, when's the last time you calibrated this thing? It's like, oh, I don't know, like 3 years ago. I'm like, yeah, that number's not real. Like that's, it's not that. I was like, have you done it for other crops? No. I was like, yeah, so this number that you're seeing means the only value it showcases is to you personally because you think it's true. I was like, but that data in anyone else's hands is garbage.
Yeah. And it's worse than garbage. It's dangerous because
You
don't throw it away, which is what you do with garbage. It leads to bad decisions, which is worse than garbage because you're making decisions on that. So it would
make this perception in the farmer's head that, oh, that area does get 120 bushels an acre. And hey, by chance, maybe it did because something happened in the right realms. But I think that's one of the, it's a giant challenge in ag and the whole ag tech side of it from all this data and people trying to build solutions around it. We've seen that problem from even, you know, newcomers coming in and saying, oh, we can do this with this data and this solution. Like, yeah, well, no, you really can't, or you're going to have a really hard time at it, to even seasoned groups that, you know, continually have an issue with it. And I mean, just with the data trust side, I mean, I've had people come up to me from a satellite image, say, you can't take a picture of my farm from a satellite. I'm like, you know, I respect your theory on that, and that's fine, but I'm not the problem. Google, go talk to Google about it, or talk to the government about it, by all means. And then they can like, oh, I don't know.
Pictures of your field. And you know what, now you can launch a sort of micro satellite, cube satellite for a couple hundred grand, right?
Oh yeah. You know, well, even when all the drone stuff was coming out, I mean, people would really make that argument. It's like, oh, you can, you know, fly right over my house. You can't do that. I'm like, well, according to the law, you can. Right. The only way you can't do it, or you can get in trouble, is if by taking that picture, you basically slander somebody personally somehow, or you devalue the property in which you flew over. Mm-hmm. And there was a case about it. It was kind of, I think it was the Air Force against some person because their farmstead, you know, and it was a farm. So, you know, it threw into there too. It was right next to an air base. And the military constantly said, oh yeah, we can fly over your house all day long. It doesn't matter, but it devalued the property value. And so the guy won the case. And that's where part of it is. I can't remember the name. I'm sure someone could, you know, you could Google it.
That's an entirely different thing because they're flying jets over there constantly that are super loud.
Yeah.
Versus, you know, you don't know that the satellite's taking pictures of your field.
Yeah. It's like if you live anywhere in a city, like, oh, the heli, you're going to sue the helicopter pilot that's flying somebody into an air med trying to save their life. It's like, but to that point, you know, with, cause you've worked a lot of on the personal data side or seemingly personal. Cause you said, you know, you're bringing in, you know, you're tying other data from your history to field boundaries or to other disparate data from, you know, phone numbers and emails. I think maybe talk through that a little bit because like, I don't understand that world very much, but yeah, you can buy a lot of data that's open out there from emails, phone numbers, addresses. Yeah. How does that world work, and how did that translate into some of the ag data, and which is, I mean, people are using for marketing and other research purposes?
Yeah, so you know, the other company that I was CEO of was a consumer data company, consumer data and analytics. So I already knew all the companies. I knew where we can get what data and how it could be used. You know, and you know, again, with Farm Market ID, we had a database of people, names and addresses, and we had a geospatial database, right? Which is, you know, field boundaries and anything that was, you know, data in a geospatial context, and we would join those together via metadata, and we do some geospatial intersections of land ownership data because we brought in all the real estate parcel data, right? Mm-hmm. So that would drives all the real estate tax and or parcel data. So we do some geospatial intersections to know who owned and operated what land, because actually the USDA data was not terribly reliable in that.
Yeah.
Land data, this is recorded. It's it's official public record. So I trusted that. I knew that was right. The USDA data was, you know, when it came to that, because it wasn't critical and necessary to administration of the farm program. So, yeah. So we kept adding and adding and adding. And the one thing that I added, well, I added real estate data, as I mentioned, and there, you know, from that, we were able to get other insights from that. Obviously what people paid for the land, and you could start to understand the economics of farming and, getting other entities that were associated with that, you know, they were holding the land in this LLC or whatever. But we brought in, other third party consumer data. There's a lot of compilers of consumer data, and this has been around since at least the 60s.
Mm-hmm.
It used to be compiled from catalogs back when people used to get a Sears catalog. And
Sears catalog is the old start to it. Who didn't have a Sears catalog?
They would compile a lot of data from catalog orders, and then they would, you know, do surveys and they would add in white pages data, which had a list of all people. Now, over the past 20 years, it's been increasingly more based on digital information. But these compilers, some big ones are Experian, actually the same company that does credit, mm-hmm. but they also have a consumer, it's different sides of their business. Company called, they're now called Data Axle, used to be InfoUSA in Omaha. They're one of the big companies. But there's all these big companies that are big compilers of consumer data covering the 300 and some million people, and well, not 300 million. It's only for age 18 or above. And that drives in some capacity nearly all consumer marketing, because it's too expensive and ineffective to try to market to 300 million people.
Mm-hmm.
And so they use this data. It's age, gender. Some of it's also, you have tables. They'll have name tables, which speak to ethnicity.
Mm-hmm.
You know, some things are inferred. Age comes from vital records. So some is compiled from different sources, but these companies have, and there's 200 different variables wide, right? So name and address, and then add 200 different variables. Now, I always pointed out some arcane stuff they had, like whether you're a collector of die-cast miniatures. Right? So some things, you know. But, you know,
I could maybe actually use that data set because for my side hustle boundary, the farm play mats of imagery, I've gotten a lot of requests from reenactment people that do like war reenactment gaming.
I guarantee you someone has a file that I could get access to. Yeah, not stealing, but license. People that are interested in reenactment.
Oh, yeah. So
that's the world of consumer data. And I kind of stumbled into it, and I was like, you know, at first a little creeped out, but then doing what I do, I always explain it as it's like being in a room full of Legos to a kid. You can put this together in so many different ways. Now you add machine learning. Like I said, we went out and created farmer personas. We did a survey of 2,000 farmers, a paid survey. And we use that as training data to train our machine learning model so that we could then apply that to the 2 million farmers and to point to the people that are most likely ag tech farmers, sustainable farmers, frugal farmers, brand loyalists, things like that. Because it's not just about what you farm. How do you think about farming, right?
Yes.
That's important to understand as well. But so all that consumer data, and then you can get phone numbers and email addresses added to it. Those are the main ones. I'm trying to think what else we might have used, but those are the main ones that we used. And from that, you can put it, like I said, the Lego blocks and metaphor, you can put it together in a lot of different ways to answer a lot of different questions. And that's what I always loved about it. I was only limited, not even by my ideas. We weren't limited by data. It was limited by, we just don't have enough resources to do all the things we want. We need 10 times the number of people to chase down and build all these things we want to build.
Well, isn't that kind of the entirety of the issue, in a sense, when it comes to around ag tech and all the data around it is,
yeah.
And that was kind of the hope with all the money that came in is, oh, we can finally, ag can get all the people and resources it needs to do all these amazing things. Yes, there was groups kind of founding parts of it or doing things early. But that hasn't really solved the problem either.
No, I mean,
or hasn't been enough. We haven't got enough, or there was too much short-term want and not enough long-term understanding. Like, how do you see that?
I think it's changing. I think in the last, you know, I can, if you think about like the waves of agriculture, you look at the turn of the century, mm-hmm. that was the mechanization, right? We used machinery to farm more land, and we were able to get more out of the land using machinery. And then we went into the biochem, genetic stuff, right? In the 60s and all that. And all that's kind of tapering off, right? There's not this huge, you know, these huge yield improvements.
Yep.
And look, Monsanto was right when they sort of bet all on Monsanto, now Bayer, bet all on data. And I think we're in the midst of the information age. Now, there's two sides of that. There's precision ag, right? Really challenging because, okay, even if you put all the data in one place, it needs to be able to talk to and it both two ways, all the equipment, yeah. the sensors, Internet of Things, you need set of standards. So the whole, that's going to play out over a quarter of a century. Okay.
For sure.
And yeah. In technology, a quarter of a century is a millennium, but mm-hmm. it's going to take a really long time.
Well, it has taken that amount of time. I mean, from when, you know, my dad and others, I mean, from the early 90s, mid 90s, things started coming off. Like, I remember seeing a brochure the other day from a, I think it was a Soil Action Ag Chem spreader. And it's like, you can variable rate four different products at the same time using XY data and software. And the brochure is from 1998.
Yeah.
And it's like, well, it could be done, but to your point, all these other.
It was feasible.
Yeah.
It could be done as a one-off, but how do you do it at scale?
Yes, 100%.
And here's the big problems that are going. You know, so I'm less interested in the precision ag stuff, but I think there's a tremendous opportunity closer to the near term to improve the business of agribusiness, mm-hmm. right? Things that are commonplace in other industries like ERP systems, you know, sort of knowledge databases, master data management, CRM, you know, sort of there's still a lot of paper.
Plenty. Yeah. Crop insurance. I worked in that. Plenty of paper and crop insurance.
So, I mean, aside from the inefficiencies of it, it creates one of the many data problems. Here's the different data problems that I think about. You know, for one, and I think it's changing, data had always been viewed as exhaust, right?
Sure.
Coming off of systems rather than fuel to make better decisions and be more efficient. So mm-hmm. I think people are starting to realize data is not exhausted. It's actually fuel. It's valuable. Another big issue is a lot of this data is buried in a lot of closed systems. These systems aren't architected to make it easier for them to be open and API
100%.
And to be able to do all these things. And you know, it's very, very fragmented, right? Not just, oh, this kind of data. You have so many different types of data that exist with different providers and different things. It's very challenging. No standardization, right?
Well, that's a fun one to cross too.
that's a tough one because you need cooperation and those. It levels the playing field for those that have less data potentially.
Well, yeah, I've been part of some of those processes and actually might be part of some newer processes around it. And everyone wants standards and it's needed so bad, just like standard definitions. Not everybody.
I was at like one of the first or second World Agritech, it was the investment summit. And I remember Robert Fraley at Monsanto. This is maybe it was right after. Was it right after the climate deal? And I stood up and I asked, you know, the question. I said, "Well, for precision ag, you know, to achieve the maximum possible yield versus the average yield, which is the total potential that you could get out of the genetics of the plant, right? And that is a information challenge, right? Mm-hmm. And the only way that we're going to be able to do that, or the way to expedite that, is some degree of standards. And of course, we know Ag Gateway has been working on that, but very little have we seen from that effort. And I said, you know, the best way to speed this up and really get the value and get yields and profitability and everyone wins is creating a set of standards. Do you see that happening? And he laughed. Because I think he knows, you know, I think certain people know that, A, first of all, it's hard. And yes. Two, you know, why would, if you're playing poker and you have aces, you don't want to deal cards face up.
Nope.
So if they agreed on standards, you know, it certainly invites other people to be able to compete on a more level playing ground. So I don't hold my breath on standards.
Well, politics too plays this for the same reasoning. The politics of it always played a thing. Another side of standards, you know, what's hard in ag. You know, okay, if there's standards in, call it, developing computer code and all that, like, okay, that's code to ones and zeros and things like that. So things kind of connect and work. But in ag, what's there, you know, talking about the precision ag side, because that plays into what standards are applied to the agronomic side of what, to your point, on the highest yield you can get. Well, every square inch of soil is different than the next square inch of soil, and how it works and reacts, and how that data can be even delivered to a certain part of the world and or to a certain type of tractor. And that's where part of the privacy part always came in, was, well, you know John Deere is the kind of the megalithic group of bringing data into tractors and in and out. Others can do it too. It's just they're winning. Well, what if they're helping develop the standard, which they kind of were with an Ag Gateway, they're also giving this tool to their competitors, was the greater good.
It's
tough.
You know, it's easy to demonize the guys at the top. But, you know, look, why would you want to give away a competitive advantage? And you could make the greater good argument that the pie gets bigger and everyone benefits, but you know, it's not that simple. And it could negatively impact them. Now, and then there's standards, but you pointed on another thing. It's like type, you know, if we could all just agree on a taxonomy, I guess that is sort of standardization, a taxonomy of data and data types, because, you know, like you said, soil chemistry, soil maps, weather. You look at all the different types of data and very temporal data, things that change every day. Mm-hmm. You know, there's so much. It's actually a greater challenge than the industries that I came from who have been using data for a long time, because you don't have that. It's very much tabular database structure kind of data, but geospatial, this temporal, non-standard. It's like, it's a really tough thing.
That's why
it's going to be another quarter of a century before we really are at least well on our way.
Well, even to that, you know, on the imagery side, you know, temporal is a big thing. Then you have spectral. So even from the soil side or anything that you're looking at a plant, it doesn't even matter really what it is. Is that spectral sensor that's looking at something, is it done in a standard process, or is it a one-off spectral sensor that someone made? And then are the algorithms standard, and are the analysis processes? And the answer is, a great example that I can bring up on, like with imagery, NDVI, everyone talks about NDVI. It's like, if you're doing NDVI, it's like, okay, sure. The algorithm is the same. You can actually break up NDVI into NDVI green, NDVI red. There's other crazy things you can do. But a lot of times, while the algorithm is the same, it's how they showcase the data. someone might do an NDVI analysis on an entire satellite scene, say 100 miles by 100 miles wide.
Right. It's relative.
Yeah. It's like, oh, well, you're also getting trees and lakes and rivers and roads in that, which is skewing the right. data once you zoom in. Or are you doing it just zoomed in on the field boundary?
It looks red. Well, you're bringing in highly vegetative species like trees.
Exactly. And so just because someone uses the standard algorithm per se doesn't also mean it's being applied correctly to that point geospatially. Yeah. And that to the point of standard, that's what becomes really hard. And you know, to that point where I think it's a great transition here is, you know, with that data, you see the recent, you know, USDA came with the latest report that, you know, farms are on decline, you know, big surprise, people are getting older, farmers are getting older, whatever, you know, nothing new there. But, you know, I wrote about it a little bit as like, because when you actually add up the numbers of, you know, everyone's chasing these, you know, high value commodity type growers making million plus dollars. And I've told people for years, and part of it was after looking at when we were first working each other on farm market ID, because you could see some of that understanding of who farmed what acres and where they were. And you could really start breaking it down. And I think we were looking through the data at one point on a larger level. And it was like, there's only 5,000 farms in the US that farm like 50% of the ground. And it was, when you actually hear it, it sounds insane. And then those are the numbers that the entire ag tech industry has been going after. Yeah. And then it gets so fragmented. Oh, we have 1 million acres under management. We have 1 million acres. Oh, we have 1,000 users. We have 5,000 users. I'm like, and I can understand from that. And I would always tell people, I was like, yeah, we're fighting over like this tiniest of pies, and it's so hard, and it's why adoption sucks. Because there's only 5,000 farmers are fighting off, and they're tired of hearing it.
But you know why no one's fighting for the 500 acre farmer? It's partly like, yeah, you want to go for the, you know, the fatter pigs, but it's also the fact that a lot of the ag tech software can't scale and work for those smaller farmers because this idea that it's just software and we all have seen the demos like, wow, that's cool. I can see doing that. And unfortunately, a lot of farmers were sold on false promises, but it's the amount of work that has to go into populating and maintaining the data to allow you to draw those insights and have all those cool pictures and, and sophistication is such that it actually, the ROI doesn't exist for the 500 acre farmer. No. I would argue, and what happens with those really large, the 2,500 acre farmer, 5,000 acre farmer, is, well, one of two things. One, at 5,000, you have employees. It's not just, you know, your immediate family. Of course, that probably only starts happening at about 2,500 acres. 1,000 acres, you're not hiring employees. At least if it's row crops. So what also happens is the channel, some of the burdens on the channel, the agronomist, you know, the retail, all these other people are there to help create it because, you know, and I think that's where Silicon Valley has stubbed its toe. This is great UX. Look how slick, how cool it is. Especially like the imagery stuff. It's always really cool. But you're like, how do you get to that use case? You only get there with a lot of human labor because of this data problem we have. Yep. The data, it sits all these different systems, different types, non-standardized, not enclosed systems, not easily brought together. And a lot of it's in the farmer's head, maybe in paper. So all the things that would go into populating that, which, you know, in a demo, you do it. It's demo data. But in practice, in reality, and to maintain it, it's like a car that you're – it's like the Flintstones car is sort of an age reference, right? They were using their feet to make it go. There was no engine. And I think, you know, that's probably an appropriate metaphor. It's like the software is fine and software is easy. Software is easy. Data is hard. Data in ag is really hard. And, you know, I think that's where we need improvement so that we can start to do some of these things that are commonplace in other industries, but recognizing that ag's data challenge is probably greater than we see in a lot of these other industries because of, you know, it's not a field level, right? Because soil test, right? You need to go subfield level. And as applied, you're subfield level. There's a lot of subfield level data. So you're talking, you know, 900 million acres against all these different data sets and its data types. It's a monumental challenge. But, you know, we need to start to create that kind of technology infrastructure that brings that data together so that we can start to power some of the software and start to everyone can start to use and make decisions on it.
So with that, you know, there's been, you know, almost kind of getting into because it kind of transitions well into the kind of almost putting money to these big problems and data. You know, money needs to be raised to do this stuff, to do the big things. There's just, you just can't do it the other way. You just can't. I've lived it and other stuff too, but there's issues right now in that. I mean, even what was it last week? I can't even remember the group. I won't call it out right now, but you know, they had to cut 60% of their staff and they were trying to do big data problems, big data analytics to help others make big decisions in the grain trading side. And that's always been a thing. And I know those were some of the things we were trying to work on together back in the past, and countless others have tried it too, is okay, let's bring these disparate things. Let's put all this together and come up with these answers. But then something doesn't work. And that it's not one thing or not. I'm a very big skeptic on yield estimation and crop classification using any sets of data, unless it's on a very micro scale, just because as you know, like people use the CLUs to maybe garner some of the acres of that or some of the past data around it, or, you know, they'll use imagery too. And, you know, the resolutions are limited. So there's this inherent plus and minus, you know, de facto take on it. And someone will be like, oh, we're within 1% of the USDA report. I was like, what does that even mean? Because the accuracy of the data is plus or minus 5% anyways. Even the USDA data is that. So what does it matter? And I get trying to get some insights ahead of that. But, you know, from that end, the investment money going into, like, help break that down a little bit, because I think you got some interesting thoughts on how that all works together from what you've done and even how money from outsiders affects that, as it's a want.
Well, what I have seen, and again, this industry, you know, and I remember seeing all the reports, they define ag tech and they have like impossible foods as ag tech. You're like, okay.
Yeah, 100%.
Maybe we need to break that down a little bit.
Right? Yeah, just a little bit. Clearly,
they're getting a lot of money. Those kind of, protein, sort of plant-based protein. And there are other areas, you know, we've seen vertical farming, aquaculture, some of those things. But in terms of when I think ag tech, I think data, software, things like that, infotech, maybe we'll call it. There really has not been very much venture money and very much private equity money. What I will tell you, I've talked to a lot of private equity companies. They really, really want to get into ag because some of these private equity companies, the really big ones, are moving to more what they call thematic investing. They're sort of looking long term in overall themes, and they see growing population, sustainability. They're seeing all these, big swings that are going to play out over the next, 10, more than 10 years, that thematically they want to be in this space because they believe it's a rising tide. And they're right. I definitely believe they're right. But a couple things. So the venture guys, there's really not a lot of, you know, venture money. I mean, what very few venture type investments that, you know, a venture investment's usually like a Series A would be 5 to 10 million. It's probably about normal. You see a lot of seed funding, you know, in ag. Yeah. So people are writing $500,000 to $1 million to $2 million checks. But you're not seeing a lot because you see these ag tech companies, they get some revenue. And we talked about how cool it all looks, but they can't get it to scale. And there's some famous failures in terms of getting a huge exit, you know, getting some Silicon Valley. A huge exit and seeing it all fall apart completely. And because they can't get it to scale for the reasons that we mentioned. But, and the really sad thing for me is I think good, healthy private equity involvement in ag is exactly what's needed to really invest into creating and solving some of these big problems, these big data problems. But there's no good entry points because EverAg, you know, there's all these, a lot of these have been scooped up. So a private equity investor wants a company that's got at least, you know, small end private equity, 5 to up to, you know, 75 million. So a $5 and $75 million info tech company.
It don't exist.
Ag focused info. It, you know, remember I was talking about the Simpsons cartoon hands, there may only be maybe less than five that I could think of would fit.
No, 100%. And that's, I remember even that before all the kind of the climate deal that all these, you know, outsiders in money came in, you know, talking to investors, I'll say from the time frames, I'll call it 2007 to 2011, when I know we were trying to talk to some different groups. Yeah, all the private equity, they're like, well, yeah, if you're not making $5 to $15 million a year, we don't even care. I was like, well, no one makes that beyond like four people, and that was then. And sure, there are some that are making, you know, just call it cash flow positive or close, but the value trends are still not great for them. And so they're just not a target for private equity. But I think you're right. Private equity needs to do it. So part of me is like, could they be switched to think of it as, and I know this is hard because, you know, software and data is kind of this intangible asset, although it's becoming more tangible, you know, data is, but that was always a problem. But take it more on, you know, when I think of buying land or a farmer buys land, it is a tangible asset. I'll give it that. But it's you don't know if necessarily how climate and other situations, disasters are going to affect what's farmed on that land. You just know it's there. It is an asset that you can grow a crop on. Well, if you can think of it as a software is a, you know, as a piece of land that you can grow data stuff with, why can't private equity think of that? Because they have no problem investing in land. Why can't they think of it that way?
I don't think private equity loves software, and they love B2B stuff.
But right? Not starting small. They need to like start like but smaller.
Well, but that's really the realm of venture investors.
Yeah.
Like I said, there's really not – there's some seed funds, but like a healthy venture investment outside of ag, this is a non-ag comment, again, is a $5 to $10 million. And that would imply usually, you know, a post-money valuation. That'd be to take your investment and then whatever the inherent value of the company was before, you know, $5 to $10 million is translating to a $25 to $50 million valuation. Well, no one's – they're not going to write a $10 million check for a company that's only been able to sign up, you know, 50 farmers and generate, you know, $350,000 revenue. Right? It's not proven.
They were. Some were.
but really, I don't think there's I know of most of the venture investors that those early stage, high risk, high return And obviously Farmers Business Network was one that was started that mm-hmm. way. But that was a unique situation because one of the founders, it was incubated within Kleiner Perkins. You know, so you really need bold steps like that. And I don't necessarily agree with FBN's strategy, but you need that level of disruption to shake things up. So I think the net FBN existing is a net good because it shook people up. I would say Monsanto, it shook people up to realize we got to do things differently. Mm-hmm. And we need to start to evolve. And information and technology, which is really how Farmers Business Network started, sort of a data co-op. But yeah, that would be more the realm of venture investors. But there's only a few that have deep, deep pockets that are going to invest that early stage, right?
Well, and you have to give up. I mean, and that's the other, I think, problem. I mean, even someone like me or other people in kind of the, that I think of at least in ag that, you know, maybe have some knowledge in ag that want to build something more. Sure. Sometimes you can get that investment if you got the right pieces, right tools, right knowledge. Crap, you got to give up so much ahead of time, and it can kind of deflate a person. And I know a lot of people that just don't want to do that, and they want to, you know, sell a product, make money, and enhance that way. And there's nothing wrong with that. I mean, that's what my dad did, and there's others that have done it from call it the ag leader side and others, and you know, plenty of small groups that are just unknown that have done that. But you can only get so far on that. And then you can get forgotten too, because you haven't raised that amount or you can't scale to the amount that that investor does. But yet there's all these smaller groups that are around that have this inherent value, but they can never get to the value point of where others want them to be. There's this, it's kind of a weird yin and yang in it all. And even the ones that have gotten a lot of money, some of them haven't, you know, lately at least, haven't done a lot with it, you know, from the revenue side.
That's my big concern is like when these true venture, high risk, high return, willing to put a lot of money to work, taking a swing, you know, taking the, because private equity investors usually don't, their risk profile is not like a venture investor, right? And so they're not expecting a 10x, 20x return necessarily. But a venture investor is. They're taking high risk, you know, and they expect a high return. And they know a lot will fail. But the problem I have, the really concern I have is let's do a post, I don't want to call it a post-mortem because that means it's over, but let's review some of the big ones. FBN. How many CEOs have they had in the last year? So clearly
they're on the fourth or
I don't think third. They're on up rounds, you know, so mm-hmm. It's not, and they've raised an absurd amount. So at this point, I don't have any inside information, but it's not clear that it's delivered great returns for investors. Now it's become this big organization, but they've raised over $1 billion. Right. So, mm-hmm. you know, you spend $1 billion, you're going to have a lot of people and revenue and customers, but can you create enterprise value? The things you see publicly aren't encouraging. Indigo, the things you've seen publicly, and I think we can pretty much, you know, they raised close to $1 billion. I mean, FBN raised even more. That hasn't gone well. You know, and so there's these really public failures of really getting value to those people that took those big investments. And so now does it scare off investors? Because they're like, hey, we believed in this industry. We think it makes sense. But okay, we're not seeing success. So, you know, success breeds success. And, you know, the venture stuff, I don't think you're going to see, unless someone really comes out with something amazing, I don't think you're going to see a lot of, you know, even $5 to $10 million, you know, funding for, you know, companies with less than a million in revenue. So then, you got to slug your way up to get to 2 to 3 to 4 to 5 so that you can be your cash flow positive. So the private equity companies will take a look at you. Problem is a lot of them got gobbled up by Everag, Telus, D10, my former company. And I don't knock those guys. Well, I will say as an overall category, have they continued to invest in the innovation that led to the growth of those companies in the first place? Across the board, you wouldn't say yes. So then you lose that. And so I think all those things are the negative things, but the need exists. And need becomes demand if you can solve a problem.
Well, yeah, the need exists. And, you know, to the point is there's this want to be acquired by whatever software startup, or even if been around for a while, it doesn't really matter. There's always a point. And yeah, like I came in through an acquisition through Telus, through Ag Integrated. And, you know, they bought 15 groups in 3 years and spent close to $1 billion. And of course, now they're selling off parts of what they bought for pennies. DTN's done that. And there's, you know, ProAgrica was buying up groups, and now they've sold now to Telus. Like, and that's not a, I mean, that's a weird sign to outsiders, investors.
Where's the investment and growth?
And trust me, there wasn't.
And innovation. I mean, growth by way of innovation, you know, solving more problems, investing in, like I said, addressing this data problem, you know, and it's going to happen. What I've always known, what I've always liked about ag is you can be clairvoyant. You can predict what's going to happen in ag in many ways because it's happened in other industries. Now, there's good reasons why these things don't happen as quickly as they do in other industries. But a lot of the themes you see in other industries do happen in ag. I think we'll start to see more marketplaces, right? Open marketplaces, particularly in the grain trade.
Mm-hmm.
At least that's something that I believe in. I know AgVend is kind of trying to create some more marketplace capabilities. So the beauty is you can take ideas. I think you're going to continue to see there's not still a lot of ERP, sort of modern ERP systems.
No, there's CRM. A group I know.
There's no CRM systems. No one uses CRMs.
You guys were kind of a CRM of sorts of sorts.
That was on my roadmap. We weren't a CRM. We were sort of CRM light, but that was on my roadmap, was to build out a CRM system, because you'd want to bring in sale data, transactional data, you know, and say, present this to this person, manage your sales interactions, your marketing, your customer, all in one place. But even the popular CRMs like Salesforce or Microsoft Dynamics aren't used very much within ag, and it will change. Ag is different. But it will change. It'll look different, and it'll certainly be
slow. And we're fighting with, you know, to the point earlier, kind of a there's a weird numbers game to it. Why some of these things aren't, you know, maybe as prevalent, because, you know, you build an ag CRM specific thing or something, you don't have a lot of clients you can sell to, you know, a couple hundred in a sense. Even to farms, if it was more farm related, well, you're only going to get the big ones. Like, you know, we're talking to have employees and are selling, you know, their own goods, which is, you know, you have a few thousand of those. And so that becomes part of the challenge. Then of course, you know, we talk about the money challenges, like where are you sitting to do these things? You know, that becomes a challenge. Time, you know, just the time to develop anything. And then even if you do all those things, you can get purchased by another group, and then they like internally don't keep it going, or, you know, that there's not a good strategic vision going forward and how to grow it.
Don't sell. take money, but don't say. I would love to see some company that says, you know what? I can, there's two in the bush. I'm going to keep going. I'm going to take some private equity money. venture money. I don't own 100% anymore, but I own 50%. But 50% of a billion-dollar company is a hell of a lot more than 100% of a $25 million company.
Oh, yeah. Let's say that
to happen. It's not a question of if it will. It's just a question of when. And hopefully, you know, the TELUS and all the acquirers are full, so that it will allow some of these. It almost seems like a metaphor of, like, you know, let these seedlings grow and build a better root structure, so that, you know, they can grow, take money, and they don't look to, you know, maybe the buyers aren't there because all these strategics are now trying to make sense of what they bought and get a return on what they bought, and that the money, the venture and the private equity is just the fuel they need to solve the next problem, to be bigger and better, rather than providing an exit for an investor. And, you know, I know myself, I've been looking for, you know, a company to sort of either acquire as, you know, and I'm like, well, I don't know. My preference isn't to start something up, but you know, what's out there to build upon. And if there's nothing out there to build upon, then you do have to start it at day zero. Yeah, I'd prefer to start, you know, a little further along, because I'm an impatient guy. But
I think anybody that gets into ag becomes very impatient, because they're like, oh, one crop a year, great. You know, it's not true everywhere, but in many cases it is. And it's very easy to become impatient.
It's true.
Yeah. Well, and you know, to that point, I think with all the stuff that's been, you know, call it learned, and, you know, people will call it different things, ag 1.0, 2.0, or ag tech 1.0, whatever, right? I hate names like that. That's just me. But I do see it kind of in, you know, from just my growing up through it, is, all right, 90s, you know, things just had to start somewhere. And there was even stuff in the 80s that was starting on the technology side. And I mean, you could go as far back as you want. A good colleague of mine has said the biggest technology advancement for farmers in the last 50 years has been the air conditioned cab on a tractor. And there's some point to that. It's like, you couldn't have all these other pieces to the puzzle if you didn't have comfortability of the farmer in the cab, or even the cushioned seat, these little progressions. And, but for the, you know, more the, you know, my world, you know, your world that you've been into is, you know, call it the software end of things. You know, it started some stuff in the 90s, you know, progressed to things in the, you know, the early 2000s, where, oh, okay, there's getting some footing in the door where things were, kind of segmentation of different areas. You know, the 2010s, you could call it the last decade, an experiment happened. Let's put a bunch of money into some stuff and see what happens, and we'll learn from it. And now we're in kind of this beginning stage of this kind of fourth decade of ag tech as a whole. It's like, okay, we're learning now. We're just finally starting to learn. And ag goes in like 30-year cycles. That's what was always told to me as a kid. And market-wise and weather patterns, whether any of it's actually that, I don't know, look at an almanac. But the next 10 years, there's a ton of opportunity from learning from what's happened, from, you know, people that have been in it, like yourself, or, you know, other people that I'll talk about on the podcast, and just others going to shows. And I'm hearing that a little more. It's like, okay, we did learn that. Yeah, that sucked. That wasn't the right thing to do, but it happened. My fear is the people that we need, that ag needs to enhance these data pieces that we're talking about, you know, make these softwares and data and talk, and, you know, from the standardization just to the exploration of new ideas, that because of the last 10 years, we've, like, the flame's not out, but we're floating on a bunch of little embers sitting around, and we need a big wind to come in and be like, hey, here it is. And I fear that won't happen as fast as it needs to, so that this next decade isn't a laggard decade in ag technology. It can be that upward growth.
If there's any venture private equity people that listen to this podcast, you know, from their perspective, it's an opportunity to get in low, get in early.
Agreed.
Because it will happen. And you're right. I think there's a lot of people that have pulled back, are afraid to, but it's going to happen. I mean, there's low hanging fruit still. Just digitizing paper things. I remember a very, very large retailer, and this is a number of years ago. And I was talking to them about kind of our farm field boundaries. And, you know, like all my product ideas came from talking to customers and understanding how they do what they do and thinking about how we could help them do it better. And every startup company should be thinking about, I just need to solve one problem first and then think about how can I develop a solution that is repeatable and scalable. But this one, it was like, I was like, well, when someone places an order of, you know, whatever, fertilizer, you know, some crop protection or whatever, you know, because the large farmers, as you and I know, if you have 1,000 acres, you may be 50 miles end to end between your furthest field, you know, the two furthest fields, right? You're over farming over multiple counties. They're not adjacent, you know, not too many people are farming 1,000 adjacent acres, 5,000, you know, those bigger farmers. I'm like, well, how do you know? Like, okay, you got to deliver it. I think I order Amazon. They know to deliver to my address. It shows up my front door. You're not, you're not delivering it to the homestead. He goes, well, we input directions in the order. I was like, what directions? I was like, I haven't used directions since about 2002. I thought he was like saying he actually meant navigation. I said, what do you mean? He said, no, you know, go down 2.3 miles, take a left on this road. And I'm like, well, then how do you optimize your deliveries, you know, to make sure that you're delivering quicker, minimize the amount of time, kind of your fleet management. They don't, very, 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 very large retailer, they don't do any of that. And I said, well, how does the farmer even tell you where to deliver it? You know, they have to describe. And I was saying, well, look, we could give you an interface. You just pick the field, and then they have the latitude, longitude, and then they know that's where it needs to be delivered. You enter the date, blah, 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 and you do it with the customer. When would you like that delivered? Please pick your delivery location. I'm thinking about how modern commerce happens. And I'm like, God, that's such low-hanging fruit. It would be a much better experience for the customers, more efficient for agribusiness. And you're like, there's 100 of those. And I think if people just get down and say, all right, I'm just going to solve one problem and think about how do I – because if one company has it, there's probably 50 that have the same problem or opportunity. Do it really well and then move on to the next one, which is hopefully adjacent. So you start to build kind of a suite of things. But, yeah, I mean, you just see it over and over again. So all the needs are out there. The demand exists if you can solve a need scalably, profitably, and, you know, hopefully the private equity and venture community in ag can look past some of these failures and realize the need exists, and you just need operators with a focused, sound business strategy and understand how do you go from a few customers and cool software to, you know, 1,000 and 5,000. How do you scale that?
It'll be good because, you know, so this is being recorded, you know, the week before the World Agritech here in San Francisco, where we're both going. I still haven't, well, you've been to North Dakota. It's beautiful right now, but the weather can change. So I'll either I'll either get there or I won't. But if I go in, I'll get it while I'm there.
A little far by snowmobile. I don't think you'd make it.
We actually have no snow right now, so we're like super early. So we're kind of lucky. So it should be fine. But then I have three little kids, so they can get sick, and who the heck knows. But I'll say, I hope, you know, I'll have this up, the Monday before. So I hope some of the people listen in just to get some of these little things. So I think, you know, the talk has been, I think it's a good gearing towards that show. Of course, I'll say if there are those investors listening, well, it seems like, Steve's got some good ideas, and I got like five different little ag startup ideas. If anyone wants to throw me some money, I'll take it. I'll take it. but you know, from kind of the perspective of where things are going, is there, I'll say this, what is the thing that, and then maybe we'll close up here, is what's the thing that excites you the most about what you've seen and what others are doing in the, call it the ag tech space, the broadness, but maybe we maybe dive it down into where you would want, maybe it's the software side or data side. And what's the thing that you think nobody's talking about?
Well, I mean, I'll answer the first one, sort of where I think sort of big opportunity movement is, and I have interest in, and it's AI and sustainability. And I remember in the early days of the carbon, I'll call it the announcement of the carbon gold rush, mm-hmm. which in my mind was like 2020, because that's yep. when it's in that year, so many ag companies made these big commitments, and I won't call them commitments, these big press releases around what they're going to do. And then like, yeah, we got a real data problem that's going to make this really hard to do.
Well, yeah, it came in overnight. I mean, because the administration changed. That's what, you know, that's what happened. And boom.
I think there's opportunity there, which really needs to focus us to, and I was doing, you know, a lot of work there, and help was part of getting a $95 million grant from the USDA on one of the climate smart commodities. But in my mind, we need two things on sustainability. We need a pragmatic, this idea that we're going to have, and when I say a smart measure additionality and things like that,
yep.
for data that doesn't exist in any of these systems we've talked about, they're maybe in their head, maybe they forgot. When did they start using a cover crop on that field? When did they change to conservation tillage? You know, do they have that recorded somewhere? Some may not. It may yeah. be in pen and paper. It may not exist. Yeah, so we needed to use remote sensing. We need to make that lessen the burden as much as possible, as well as get out of this idea that we need to do deep soil test to look at carbon stocks in the soil. Because I'm like, well, how many of those do you do? You can't do one per field, because throughout the field, it's going to have different carbon stocks. Yeah, you know, we need to use data science, statistical sampling to measure and estimate carbon, a set of standards around how to do it. And I saw the USDA recently put out, you know, typical government thing, they put out a pronouncement, you know, like, what exactly are they doing? Not real sure, but it was very clear they are trying to create some standards, change all this sort of wild, wild west and chaos that's existing right now.
Yeah, that's needed. Yeah.
Right. So I think MMRV system that is really thoughtful and modern, using passive data collection, pre-populating data, potentially getting the USDA to open up their data to people that are doing these things so they can tap into an API, which
you want the government to create an API to tap into. Are you insane?
I want to, I'm not saying they will. Okay. Two different things.
But
you know that. And then I think obviously AI, which obviously is transforming and so on everyone's thought process. Mm-hmm. Do you think yeah. about all the different types of data, the massive quantities of data, and the difficulties of structuring and building it together into a consolidated master data management system or something like that, AI can kind of bridge some of that. I think AI can be helpful in some of the data problems. So those are the two, you know, things that I'm excited about and I'm interested in, and I think will play out over the next 10 years.
Well, and just to speak to that a little bit before the last question, I challenge you to answer. You know, with that measuring side, that's been one of the problems, and even from the remote sensing side, there are limits to what you can remotely sense. Now, some have gone a little further than what I think is, I wouldn't say even possible, but that like is feasible, where I trust it. You know, and some of that is that carbon side. I would rather see people put a probe in the ground, multiple probes in the ground, and get a good detection from it. No, 100%. And that is a problem, unless it's heavily incentivized somehow through some sort of government program, which it's not going to really happen that way unless something crazy happens. So there needs to be a different way.
But here's the thing. You're answering that from the standpoint of being field centric.
Yes, 100%. Yeah.
The people that are buying either the
they don't care, or the
carbon offset or insetting, what they care about, and I've used this analogy to help people understand how I'm thinking about it, is investors don't buy individual mortgages. You buy a mortgage-backed security. You buy a portfolio. And you can report the statistics on the portfolio. So let's say, having deep soil probes for carbon stocks in the soil, having one every 50 acres throughout the field, you're going to be more accurate. Yes. Okay. Won't scale. We got to come up with a better way. Now, if you're talking about 50 million acres or 10 million or 5 million acres, you statistically sample, make sure that you have the right geographies, you know, distribution, and you sample, and you do those tests in those sample locations. And then you're able to basically run a report and do the statistical work. I'm trying to simplify it without getting geeky. Such you can report in aggregate, here's the accuracy rate and margin of error, because you have the sample set that you've tested against, and you've used this training data to train the model to adjust for the fact that, not every field is going to be right, because it doesn't matter. If you're off, if you're plus 5%, another one's down 5%, you're exact on average, right? So and ultimately that's what they're buying. They're buying certain tons of carbon or a certain number of bushels of sustainably grown soybean, whatever that is defined as. And it doesn't have to be right on an individual bushel level. It doesn't have to be right on field level. And if we're thinking that way, we're going to be sitting here 10, 15 years from now, and we're going to be like, whatever happened with that? Does it really work?
I think there could be, I think of it this way, and I was at a recent conference around all the, you know, carbon sustainability stuff locally around here. Great talk. And they laid it out very similar, somewhat what you were saying, in the sense that, like, it's not so field specific. It's broader, it's larger, to your point, for the security side. And so that was being explained to farmers. And there was quite a few there, 100 or so. And then it was talked about, well, what grabbed their attention was insetting. The offsetting part has been off-putting for farmers. The insetting part is getting really, they're really intrigued by that. I saw that a lot. So I think, and it looks like there's this, it's getting separated, but then it also needs to like work together. And there's a lot of ways to go about that.
The future is not offsets. And here's why. This should be really covered in the sustainability talk. There's a thing called science-based targets that companies sign up to. And it basically says that if you sign up to this, you are not meeting your carbon or greenhouse gas goals by way of offset. Mm-hmm. You can't be a bad actor and pay someone else, you know, and say, hey, look, we're net zero.
Yeah.
If you sign up to science-based targets. So the demand for carbon credits or less. Now, what it requires and what people are really focused on is lowering your scope 3 emissions directly. So sourcing a lower carbon corn or lower carbon of soybean. Now, a lot of that today is driven by the renewable fuels and a lot of the California standards. But going forward, I think you're going to, I can tell you because I've talked to a lot of these companies, there is demand from the product companies, mm-hmm. right? The food companies to lower their scope 3 emissions. To have some, well, first of all, to have some reasonable accuracy and visibility into their scope 3 emissions, and then also to be able to lower it because their customers are demanding it and asking, their stakeholders. And we are now going into a world that climate disclosures are going to go into place mm-hmm. in the next 12 months. Now, the SEC, I think, has backed off of scope 3 to some extent for now, because scope 3 is hard. But ultimately, yeah. that is coming. And so you want to be able to show positive progress towards that. And what do you do if corn is corn and beans are beans and you can't source sustainably, you can't source low carbon?
Yep.
What are you supposed to do? Right. And so that yeah. I think that also creates an opportunity to decommoditize the row crop commodities and enlarge the pie. Right. So there's more yeah. revenue yep. available to farmers because consumers are paying more for environmentally friendly climate, identity preserved kind of things.
Yep.
So the demand's there, the money's there. We don't have a real good mechanism in between the farmer and those food companies. And no, I think it's something that will happen.
If I could farm myself again, which trust me, it's a goal. I'd do some fun, very interesting things that way. But anyway, so okay, we'll close up here, and now my dog's barking. So now we really got close.
You're welcome.
Yeah, no, that's yeah. Just keep it short. What's the thing that you don't think anybody's talking about right now that can really make an impact? Even my dog's barking. He wants the answer too. So,
jeez.
On the spot.
Everyone's talking about everything, but no one's doing very much.
Maybe that's just it.
Well, I would say if I'm forced to answer, the only thing I could come up with is maybe a better suite and or solution for farmers to manage their financial risk. It struck me as odd, very fragmented. Farmer deals with lender for real estate, maybe an operating loan lender. They have PNC insurance. They have crop insurance. They have grain marketing. They have wealth management, financial services. And I'm like, they're focused on producing a crop, profitably, but so much of their profits are driven by some of these financial services and risk. And I think, especially with farmers' net rent, what is about 55% and growing of farmland is rented.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
I think better financial services capabilities, maybe it's an integrated solution, which also could play into sustainability, because if I'm a lender, if I'm an insurance company, if you have practice regenerative sustainable farming, your outcomes are going to be less variable, right? You'll have less ups and downs, right? Because you have soil fertility, weed resistance built in. You don't need to, you're not as exposed, oh my God, we need to hit it with nitrogen, or, we're using chemicals to produce a crop and you have a lot of inherent soil fertility. So I think that's one. I said I didn't have any. I still think we need to solve how farmers buy, sell, and rent land. It's a word of mouth backward kind of. And if I hear another company say they're the Zillow of ag and look nothing like Zillow,
I'll give a perfect example of, and I dealt with it with my with my mother-in-law, but part of the problem was, and it happened fine, but there's maybe a different side to it that I would add to that. So my mother-in-law she's widowed and rented her land to the local farmer for a long time. Well, that local farmer was, let's just say, not paying what they really should, but there was this fear. And there's a lot of, I'll call it, you know, widowees out there that have this fear that no one wants to rent their land or they'll ask too much for it. They're in the dark.
Do they even know what it should go for?
Exactly. And while there are a lot of progressive people that are going for the higher rents because of all this data, I think where the thing that no one's talking about is actually, and there's going to be this huge land wealth transfer over the next, you know, 20 years, you know, which is going to be insane. A lot of that is from people that just aren't educated on what it really is and reaching, getting them. And that kind of, maybe that brings a whole big loop back to what kind of you were doing and running on the farm market ID side and some of that data, how important that is maybe we need to stop selling some of these, call it services agronomically from climate, all these things to, you know, young whippersnappers in their 20s and 30s and 40s, or even 50-year-old, 60-year-old farmers, and talk to the 80-year-old little old lady that's getting screwed on her rent, but yet she's worth $20 million. Because things like that, because where's that land going to go, and who's going to do that, and how do we get the most value for those, some of those people?
It all plays into financial services, and especially the aging farmers. They absolutely can fund their retirement, but they don't. A lot of them don't want to sell their land. How do you access that wealth for retirement? Well, there's lots of ways to do it. You know, the equivalent of a reverse mortgage, some sort of home equity interest only loan. Like, to me, it's odd that why do we have amortizing loans when the bank shouldn't want you to pay it off to only replace it with another loan? The land doesn't depreciate. So,
not yet.
I know real estate and probably finance probably better than I do ag. And I just look at what happens there. And I'm like, that's not a hard one. Some of these other ones we talked about throughout this podcast are tough challenges. That one doesn't strike me as that overwhelmingly difficult, because their needs and wants aren't so very different from others. People own their house. They want to know what they could sell it for. They want to find a house. They want to know what they should pay for. They got to look for houses for sale. There's really no good way to do that. You want to rent some land. You want to rent a house. It's easy. You go on Zillow or apartments.com and you can search and filter. You can't do that now. So those are relatively easy things. So, but again, we've had predecessor organizations that did a poor job of executing against that need. But that doesn't mean the problem doesn't exist, and it doesn't mean it's not solvable, because it is.
Yeah.
And again, I'd say that's probably one of the easier ones. But
well, and maybe, hey, you said you wanted to start a new thing. I'm independent. We might as well just start this new whatever company, right? Whatever it's going to be. And we'll be at the same place next week. We'll go grab a bunch of money.
There you go. We'll get aren't they supposed to be funded on cocktail napkins anyway? So just write it down on a cocktail napkin.
Yeah. But so, yeah, anyways, I guess we'll close it out now. We got plenty of content and good things to talk about. So once again, thanks Steve for being a part of this and having a great conversation, and there will be plenty more to talk about it, but thanks again. And
see you next week, hopefully.
Yeah, that's the plan. And for everyone listening, thanks for listening, share, subscribe, all the things for Ag Uncensored, and we'll see you next time. Thanks.